Okay, our next and final case on our oral argument calendar is A18-1865, Russell Vanderweel versus Sharna Ann Walgren. Ms. Nordhunt, our sincere apologies for our failure to give notice to you, and thank you so much for rearranging your schedule to be here today. Kudos to your staff for noticing.
It was just happenstance to look into the docket because of my other scheduling, and I saw it, and so it worked out. So
okay, well, we really appreciate your rearranging your schedule so we could keep this case on track, and thanks very much. We're sorry for that. You're the only party appearing today, so
That's correct, Your
okay,
Honor.
15 minutes, of course.
May it please the court, my name is Kay Nordhunt, and I represent the appellant Sharna Walgren. The trial court acted contrary to Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 17.02 and violated appellant's due process rights in appointing a guardian ad litem to represent appellant, an adult, without an incompetency adjudication and made without a provision of written notice and without the opportunity to be heard after notice had been provided. As the Second Circuit stated in Nielsen versus Colgate-Palmolive Company at 199 Fed 3rd at 651, because a litigant possesses a liberty interest in avoiding the stigma of being found incompetent and in retaining personal control over the litigation, the due process clause limits the trial court's discretion with respect to the procedures used before appointing a guardian ad litem. So in accord with Rule 17.02, requires the trial court to appoint a guardian ad litem only if it first determines the party is incompetent, which follows under these circumstances when there's written notice of a hearing, that there's something presented under oath requesting such a hearing, and that there is such a hearing. Now, the very purpose, as the court as well, of a guardian is to protect the interests of the incompetent person, not the opposing party. And the purpose is to protect, not to punish.
Can I ask, I appreciate your arguments on this. I just generally, just like sort of stepping back, I mean, your client's counsel, as I read, you know, the conversation with the court, is pretty much saying she really needs a break from this, and this is going to be so harmful. I know it's her counsel talking, and I understand the notice and the hearing and so on, but it seems very problematic to have her very lawyer saying this will be so devastating to her to continue this litigation. And the district court, I don't think the district court needs to grant a continuance. The case had been filed over a year earlier, or around a year earlier, I think. I mean, it just seems problematic to be able to come in and have your lawyer say, I can't participate because of my health. And then later, well, you should not have appointed someone to actually make this case go forward.
Well, I think there's a real difference between asking for leeway to have a period of time. Now, if we're talking, I don't know which point in time you're talking about.
I think at the end, where I think her lawyer was basically saying that she can't participate safely for her health, and then the court appointed a guardian. I mean, I don't think the court needed to continue it. I guess the court's choice could be, no, I'm not continuing it, and that's at your own health risk. But, you know, it doesn't seem that unreasonable based on what her lawyer is saying. I understand the district court's perspective on it.
And I think it is unreasonable because there can be a number of reasons why, in the scheme of things, you need a break, and not just because of some mental, you know, deficiency or problems that you're having at that time. It could be other health-related issues, such as heart, cancer, whatever. So that the idea that you then jump to the notion that the client is incompetent.
But does that presume then that the district court had to give a break?
No.
I mean, so if the district court chose not to give a break.
But actually what's interesting is the district court chose to give a break, mm-hmm. and also appointed a guardian, which is what makes absolutely no sense, because...
Well, the order seems to suggest that the court was looking to the guardian for an opinion as to whether a guardian was needed.
Right, and that clearly is not the job of whoever is appointed guardian. It's the trial court's obligation to determine in the first instance whether a guardian is needed, and they can only appoint a guardian for an adult if the adult is found to be incompetent. And so there's no finding here of incompetency.
So can incompetence mean, like, let's say, take a case where, let's assume for a moment there was, you know, that her affidavit was later, and it said, I cannot participate in this case without damaging my health severely. And the lawyer says, she can't participate. And the court says, this has been around too long, I'm not continuing it. I'm going to appoint that with notice, let's assume. I guess, can competency equal someone's statement, I cannot participate because it will hurt me? Or does it have to be, I can't understand?
I think it has to be, I can't understand. It has to be a higher level than I just can't now participate. And
if a party felt that he or she couldn't participate because of emotional or physical vulnerability, there would be nothing preventing that party from stipulating to the appointment of a guardian ad litem.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And what's different here is the fact that my client did not want a guardian, did not stipulate to that, and you have the adverse party who's coming in and saying she should have a guardian. And under those circumstances, I mean, the due process requirement is you have the written notice, and then you have a hearing where you bring in and explain why there is incompetency or there's not. But you don't do it, and so that's why it's different when you have an adverse party. Because certainly, I mean, there's a lot of times where the party themselves, and the rule provides for, you know, like a parent or somebody, you know, saying this person needs a guardian, and then you don't need this written notice. But when you have an adverse party coming in, then you need these due process requirements, which is an opportunity to respond, to bring in, you know, the healthcare professional to explain why that the person is not incompetent.
So if I could just take a step back and make sure I understand your position on this, looking at the Rule 1702. So you're not saying that for a guardian to be appointed, a party to an action already has to be deemed incompetent, whether it's in the probate court or civil commitment. You agree that someone under this rule can be, after hearing a notice, deemed incompetent for purposes of that proceeding. Is that correct?
That's, yes.
Okay, because that was not... It's not like there's a Minnesota case that clearly says that. Would you agree with me about that?
No, I agree. I mean, when you look at the comments, they kind of direct you to the probate code.
The ones from the late 50s.
Yes, probably. Yes.
And the probate code's changed a lot since then. Do we have, the way I look at this case, I don't think we have to, but tell me, I mean, your brief talks about, well, in deciding whether someone's competent, we should look to the probate code as opposed to these other things. We don't have to reach that, do we?
No, you don't, but it's... We did that because I don't know how far down the road the court's going to go with this case, but no, you can end at the fact that there was no notice, there was no finding or adjudication of incompetency that ends it.
So you're basically, tell me if I'm wrong about this, asking the court, us to read into Rule 17.02 because of the due process, the requirement that written notice be provided when an adverse party is petitioning for a guardianship under this rule. You're asking for that, correct?
Correct.
And you're also asking that, and then the individual who's the subject of that guardianship petition is entitled to a hearing and a written decision about competency. Is that, I mean, am I synthesizing this correctly?
That's correct.
Okay.
And what I did is, and we've cited to the court in the brief, the federal courts have had some cases, and especially with the due process considerations, and recognizing that, you know, due process at minimum requires notice and an opportunity to be heard. And when you read Rule 1702, it provides that you need, when it's an adverse party that's coming in and making this suggestion, then you need written notice, and then you need a hearing.
But from your perspective, what you're asking this court, you're not, as I read your brief, but tell me where I'm wrong, you're not asking us to say, okay, you need a notice and a hearing, go back. You're just asking us to reverse and say.
Just to reverse and vacate the order, because on this record, I mean, there is no basis for what the trial court has done. I mean, the trial court necessarily would have to also make a finding of incompetency, which the trial court didn't do, and instead it shifted it to the guardian ad litem, which is actually a lawyer, to advise the court whether the appellant is incompetent, which makes no sense.
I think part of it might have been to keep it going in the interim, sort of the discovery. I think there was some idea of, I mean, I guess just overall, I appreciate the arguments. I guess just overall, just again stepping back, a party who is resisting going forward, who's saying, I can't go forward, another party who wants a dissolution of the marriage, you don't want that other party to also steamroll a party that's unable to go forward. You know what I mean? I mean, I understand that the court wants able representation for wife or help for wife so she doesn't get abused I mean, I understand that you're saying the record's not there and stuff, right. But that's why I have some concerns about the competency, having to understand, because if you had a case where the wife is saying, I just absolutely can't go forward, this is ruining me, I quit, and then it's like then the divorce or the dissolution goes forward with just one party, you know, it could be really disadvantageous to that person, right?
I understand, but I think that the court has to be very, very careful when there isn't a stipulation with regard to incompetency, and when you have an adverse party, that the court is in rushing to judgment because of the stigma that is associated with being declared incompetent. And also you're taking away the personal control of the litigation, because you look at what happened here is the trial court says, okay, the discovery is December 15th, and I am the guardian ad litem now is going to inform me, the judge, about the property, the spousal maintenance, all of the issues, and then says, well, then on January 4th, you're going to report to me whether the appellant's incompetent. I mean, so what the trial court did is it took away the control without a finding of incompetency and actually kind of recognizing that there wasn't any finding. And so that's why none of this complies with Rule 1702. And so that's why we've asked the court, you know, it came up here under the collateral order doctrine, the court accepted jurisdiction, that this is, you know, an important issue that needs to be resolved before this goes back. And that what we're asking the court to do is to reverse the order appointing a guardian ad litem, and actually to vacate it, and that, you know, we go back and go through the divorce proceedings.
Do you have more? Okay, well, thank you very much again, and thanks for accommodating us with this. That completes our oral calendar. We're going to step out for a bit. I'll be back to see the students in a few minutes, but we'll just take a little break. Thank you.